the 174th session of the Literary and Scientific Society. And I would like to welcome our guest chair tonight, Andrew Carruthers, who a decade ago in the 164th session was our president. He's also an honorary life member, so if everyone give him a round of applause. For this tonight's debate, which is the Reformation debate, this House regrets the Reformation. First of all, are there any council announcements in the House? Would you like to go first?
I'm Darren Hamill, I'm the internal convener, so I convene internally. So, this Monday we have an Irish Times debate training workshop. So, for any of you that made the poor decision to come to the Irish Times and had any of my last year, you'll have seen that while it is absolutely a mentally draining competition, it is as good as it gets on the island when it comes to debating. So if you want to learn to take your debating skills up a notch, if you really want to kind of learn how to debate and how to be really fucking good at it, I would suggest... I'd also really like to see some of you enter it next year, but if you're unsure, think about it, tease them with the idea, or even if you just want to learn how to do these studies, it's quite a terrific base, but a little bit more aggressive, then I would seriously advise coming along to workshop on Monday at 7 o'clock in the PFC.
Kira, do you have something to say?
Yeah, also, like, if anyone wants, I do have, like, a document that has every single training video that the Irish Times has ever hosted, as well as several motions that the Irish Times has hosted, as well as several examples of semi-finals and finals, if people want that as well, or I'll pass it on to Rory.
Well, I actually should announce as well, the motion for it will be the one I did in the semi-final, which is this House believes mandatory coalition will be necessary.
No,
because the way I see it is, if you want to do the Irish Times, you won't learn how to take the OI, second Irish Times debater. This will be very different from training workshops normally, where
it'll be well run.
With the person, the person hosting it would normally would sit as a judge. I'd be debating alongside all of you, doing the exact same speech I did today, and not giving the exact same style of POIs, because if you want to learn how to do the Irish Times, you may as well learn how to do it with the same pressure of the Irish Times. So please do come along, because it will be, if anything, from the brag, and we'll do a fine club afterwards.
Any other council announcements, Ryan?
I think I have three. So the first one is thank you to everyone who came along to the drum debates on Monday. It was a lot of fun, and we also raised about £80, taking our total foot raise for the self-class food bank to £200. The other announcement I have is about our annual formal, which is not next Monday, but the Monday afterwards. So if you want to come along to that, please, there's a form on our Instagram that has a link to that, so you just need to sign up to that, or just come up to me and say, I'd like to go to the formal, and yes. And the also, if anyone has already signed up and needs to pay, then please give me the money, and or if you don't have cash, you can always send it to me via electronic means. The final announcement actually I have is that the Literary Figures teamed up with the Imagine Festival to host the debate not this Sunday but Sunday afterwards in the Great Hall on the motion this House believes the Good Friday Agreement has failed our generation. It's for the 25th anniversary, so we've got lots of guest speakers coming along to that, including Lord Weir, Owen Tennyson, the MLA, David Kerr, who was Lord Trimble's press secretary, and Matthew Oates will be doing it again. And then,
he's a long-running friend.
And Stephen Goss, who was a member a decade ago, might also be doing it, depending on availability. So, but also we need three student speakers for it. Two on the proposition, because I'm sure we'll find. There's two. Very religious. So there are two spaces on the proposition for that, and one on the opposition. So if you either believe that the Good Friday Agreement has failed, or strongly don't believe that, then message me to sign up for that debate.
Is any other council announcements? Okay, so I have my own council announcement. If you haven't already heard from me a million times, I have been harassing every single person I know to try and take on people, but this weekend is our inter-varsity debating competition, and we have a bunch of Southerners, some people from Liverpool, a person from Cardiff as well, coming to debate here at Queen's on the weekend. And sadly, because it's, you know, Paddy's Day weekend, there aren't that many hotel or hostel places. So if you're able to host a Southerner on Saturday night, you don't have to feed them. Just let them sleep on your sofa. They'll bring a sleeping bag, a nice patch of ground will do. Please let me know. Message the society sooner rather than later. It would help out a lot. And with that, that's the end of my council announcement. So I'll invite James Orchin, HLM, up to take the minutes.
Just like to look before I start, the reason I'm sitting halfway around the table is not that I have any sympathies with the opposition. as an Anglican, I don't. But rather, it's because I've been shunted across by our dear President, who's also stolen my gavel and bell. So, to begin, on the 9th of March 2023, in case you don't know what year it is, the Queen's University Literary and Scientific Society convened for the 20th ordinary meeting of the 174th session, the annual Dufferin competition, to debate the motion. Oh, nobody was actually quite sure at this point what it was going to be. As usual, the meeting began with announcements. Ryan Hoey, HLM, announced something beginning with C and ending in Oni. I wonder what it could have been. Anyways, he also announced that another round of drunk debates was going to be held the following Monday. For those of you who weren't there, it's already happened. Please don't try going to it this Monday. Anyways, President Tosh McSparren then introduced the judges for the Dufferin, which was a motley crew of individuals, which I can really summarize it, was a sort of a depressing revival of Gilbert and Sullivan's Trial by Jury, where nobody could sing or act. Mainly because I was on there as well. Anyways, following a reading of the minutes, Dermot Hamill announced the motion. This House believes the rise of America has done more harm than good. When the speakers went out, we decided to have some private members' business, and what a joy it was. Sam Hazlitt expressed his outrage at the price of stamps being raised to £1.10. We really know how to discuss the major political issues of our age, don't we? Responses were heard from Megan Hewitt, myself, Dermot Hamill, and Noel Barnley. Dermot Hamill then raised the SU elections and told the House that he was canvassing in a three-piece suit, which is probably why his preferred candidate lost. And I'd like to note that that was actually not put in by myself, it was instead put in by Mr. Ryan Hoey. Anyways, as we all know, the SU elections were wholly uncontentious, and we are now entering a land of milk and honey where we'll have, quote-unquote, a better SU. Thomas Cheadle then expressed the view that it was in fact snowing, proving that climate change is indeed fake. I concur with that position. Anyways, the meeting then moved on to the President's questions. Dermot Hamill asked the President to condemn the French. She did, thankfully. Ryan Hoey then asked the President, I've lost my position, what she had for breakfast, which President Emeritus Paul Shannon confirmed had been asked continuously for over a decade. My God. Anyway, she responded that she had noodles for breakfast.
Shit.
I agree. Which caused Dermot Hamill to call for her resignation. Well, surprise. After the President's questions of the vote and prior opinion was held, there were 15 votes for aye, 12 votes for nay, and zero Alliance voters. Thus, it was similar to a vote out sort of west of the ban. So in other words, the proposition had it. First in the proposition was Keira Swale. Yay. She argued that individualistic nature of the United States is spread across the world, causing governments globally to neglect their poorer citizens. I don't understand. Keira then berated the rise of America first while also attacking American interventionism. So it's too interventionist but also too isolationist, too hot, too cold for little Miss Goldilocks over there.
Anyways,
be quiet. First in the opposition was Tom Burns. He began by saying that all countries have their flaws. Coming from somebody from a certain county, that's not much of an understatement. But America acts as an important counterweight to many more malignant superpowers in the world, such as Russia and China. He argued in favour of the idea of America, it's important in spreading liberal democracy across the world and its cultural impact. And then everyone held hands, sang kumbaya, and we went to a land of milk and honey that's known as Utah. Anyway, second on the proposition was Cormac McSpire. He started by condemning the US for its expansionism and of third world nations for its own benefit. He listed off a number of countries which America had intervened in and the negative impacts of it, before concluding by saying that World War II was meant to be the war to end all wars, which is just not true. It was World War I. But he also said the Marshall Plan was bad because it helped people in Western Europe after the war, and it didn't help people in East. I don't know, I really don't understand. Anyways, he's an expiring, what do you expect? Anyways, second in the opposition was Luke McGuire. Well, well, well. He's also not here, funnily enough. He began by stating his love for America and that he was a quote unquote a big stand for the Donald, before accusing the proposition of being communists. I can see where he's coming from. He argued that the United States has a responsibility for the entire free world, and then, in response to the POI, ended up defending violence, saying that we should not accept peace at any cost. Let me just say that the substance of the speech was quite suspect, but the fact he spoke so forcefully and confidently helped him in the adjudication. Third on the proposition was Terence Pringle Metcalfe, Esquire. He accused America of hypocrisy for claiming that proclaiming to promote life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, given the fact that it was stained with the original sin of slavery. He then went on to deride the Second Amendment and mass shootings before warning of the cultural impacts of McDonald's and Star Wars. For once, there was no mention of music, which was quite something. Third in the opposition is Jack Sands. He made the case that the US has contributed significantly to the standards of living we enjoy today, with the US Navy policing shipping routes that support global trade. He argued that we should not take America for granted, because lots of things we rely on daily would not be possible without existence. I had to confess, I thought he was going to give a mean speech. He actually gave a very good one, so I would say he does a genuinely good job there. You know, two people agree with that. The final speaker in the proposition was Matt Walker. He started by denouncing American imperialism and expansionism and its historic role in the slave trade. He argued the US was going backwards in its protection of rights and that the huge wealth inequalities were undermining the idea of America's meritocracy. He also added that he also works at the US consulate and thus was on tape criticizing and attacking America. Sadly, the unemployment rate has gone up by one at least in South Belfast in the last week. While speaking to the opposition was Rory McSpire, and he began by pointing out that the opposition were not arguing that the United States has done no harm, but rather overall it's done good. He made the case the US had inspired the age of revolutions. I was sitting there salivating at this, saying, yes, 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 this is right up my alley, please continue, we have another history debater. Rory concluded by saying the proposition wants to blow your head off and make you purr. Okay. Questions were heard from Alton McSpire and HLM, Noah Barnley, Jacqueline Bonner, and Megan Hewitt. Following a long deliberation in the snow, a bit like Jack Nicholson at the end of The Shining, the judges returned and Dermot Hamill announced that the winner of the Dufferin Award for Best Speaker was Rory McSpire. President Emeritus Paul Shannon then announced the winners of the Shannon Award for Best Team were Tom Burns and Luke McGuire. May God have mercy on our souls. May I take a minute as well?
Thank you, James, for that very eloquent reading of the minutes. And we're now moving on to private members' business, where if there's anything you've seen on the news or just something you really want to bring up in-house, you can go on ahead now. Go to Dermot first, seeing as he had to stand up for.
So, with reference to tonight's audience, I thought that in the spirit of Martin Luther, I would make my own 95 pieces. These were not about religion, however, but about why us as a society should, in fact, coup Dutch Inspiring. I'm not going to read out all 95, but I'm going to give you some of So I'm going to include Scousers, because Talbot and Central and Mount Liverpudlians towards Fabian Society, which I think, well, because it was a resignable offence in itself. She's also not from North Down. She's from North Belfast. She calls it Derry. She is both a latte drinking liberal and a woke lefty. She can't play fool. She flouted the Marxists. She's shorter than most of our literary presidents in the last 10 years. She is, in fact, not the Margie and the HLM. She lost the gavel bell and gown. She's not Mitt Romney. She's not her dear. She has continued to accept the existence of the Irish Free State. She's an English student. she's a creative writing student, and she is refusing to let me tour. So that is why, my friends, we as a society ought to do something fine. And I heard that she is the tyrant that she is. The day after the 8th of March, she comes in here in her red shoes, worse than Caesar himself. So, except not her tyrant, who is not inspiring.
Does anybody else have anything on Dermot's art piece? Yes, we not. Any other pieces of private members' business? So the man in the black jumper, please state your name for the minutes.
Noah Barnley. I was on the BBC News website this week, and I saw that the United States, Australia, and the UK have reached a further agreement on countering malevolent superpowers like China and Russia, as was mentioned by Tom last week. I was wondering what the House thought of this, and what he's offering with nuclear weapons, just in general.
I'll go to Sam first.
I think there should be more of them. That's all.
You had your hand up?
Patrick.
I do agree there should be more nuclear weapons, but they should be all aimed directly at Russia, China, and the axis of evil. Across the world, of course.
There has to be a hell of a lot.
There can only be peace through nuclear strength. As Ronald Reagan once said, peace through strength.
I think it's really, really, really not good. And I don't know if anyone's actually been reading it. It's full on, like, it's escalating really, really badly towards actual conflict, which, again, James, you can celebrate that all you want. But you don't want to be chipped off towards, you know, Ukraine or Russia to go and, you know,
have stomach on the
side. All right, he's exempt from the rest of you, right?
I'm gay, I'm sort of.
Back to Dermot.
It actually does relate to my naked pair of faces. Because two of them were Tablet's plan does not own an aircraft carrier. And she also does not own a nuke. So how are you going to defend this society from perilous things such as Southerners?
Anything on the militant wing of the literature? Back to Noah, I guess.
I was just going to say one further point with the nukes is as was established in this society was nuclear energy and nukes as a whole are really great for the environment, so I think
any other pieces of private members' business? Jodie.
Okay, so obviously there's a lot going on in the world right now. We've got obviously a threat of nuclear war, there's different political tension, cost of the crisis, the world's going to shit. And at the epicenter of all this, we have the Hailey Bieber and Slay Jonas. I wanted to know, does the House side with A, Hailey Bieber, B, the right answer, Selena Gomez, or C, which is another right answer, would we all simultaneously hit Justin Bieber because he's stringing along two women and treating both of them like shit all at once?
Why are you? Okay.
I can't say I didn't want Russia to win.
Anybody actually on Selena and Haley?
Thank God.
Any other pieces of private members' business? Sam?
I brought this up last week, but given that the turnout was something akin to a Green Party conference. Tony's worth again raising the point of the abhorrent event of stamps rising to £1.10. And I wondered if anyone sensible in the House has any opinions on this.
Anybody on stamps?
I guess I'll go on stamps, considering we discussed it last week. Yes, it is an outrage. But luckily, our saviour, Jeremy Hunt, has come along with a fantastic budget yesterday, which will reduce inflation and hopefully reduce both threat of inflation and stamp inflation, which both are a disgrace.
I'll go to Kira.
Yeah, so like, inflation hit me the hardest, probably in general. But here's the thing, because of inflation and the fact that I cannot physically justify spending, I think it's £3 on a day ticket on the bus, I walked more, which is great. great, but I couldn't walk for ages. And then I found out that instead of £3, the TransLink have decided to raise their prices to £3.70, which, to be honest, annoys me so much, considering that here it's £3.70, in most European nations it's about half that. So yeah.
I think that this is actually all the result of your revolt left in Marxist politics. And I think as a result you should resign.
Any other pieces of I'll go to Terrence actually.
It was something before the hormones kicked in. Meet you collect stamps. With the pride of my collection was a 2.5p first class stamp with a Scottish embossed emblem on the top of it. And well, I won't say when it was, but it wasn't that long ago. And the first stamp produced was a penny back, 1 penny to 2.5p over the course of 130 years. From now, we're over a pound. Thank goodness no one sends letters anymore, that's all I can say.
I forgot to mention in my rant about inflation that the only thing that hasn't experienced inflation is the price of conversazione, which is actually great. £5
for non-members
for about decades, so there's that.
I just wanted to ask off of my compass that it actually is an inflation of last year's that actually read the books,
yes, well,
so that we made absolutely no money with a deficit, at which point it was technically £2 cheaper just to put the society into debt.
I'll go look first and then Dermot.
Go over there.
On inflation, as a result of inflation and liberalism, we've had to raise it. We've had to raise it from 95 to 96. This is because Tory policies have caused inflation. Come into the room.
I would blame the merging of Lutheranism and postmodern neo-Marxism, which you are. For the reason of inflation, and I would say if you cannot afford the bus, just get a bike or walk. So that's why we should get out of cars.
Just to clear the record, I am politically neutral and have no opinions on politics. Any new pieces of progress?
If there's one person that could come along and solve the problem at the moment, it's unfortunately not you to do it. It's the one and only hero of Donegal and further afield is one Bertie.
Anybody on Birdie?
Do you know how many people have actually spoken on this here?
Unlike the Tory policies which have caused inflation, Birdie never did any.
Okay, I'll take two more people and then we'll move on. Okay.
You can't have inflation if you only win it on the horses. It's a niche.
Is there anybody else? Amazing. Right. And with that, we'll move on to President's Questions, where you have 5 minutes to ask me anything you want, and I have to answer. So I'll go with Ryan first.
What did you have for breakfast this morning?
Okay, I had something slightly more normal. I had toasted wheaten bread with jam on it, and it was very nice.
Boring.
Covering the whole spectrum. go on to Durban.
Which is your favourite of the 96 species?
I have two. There's one and it's just woman, and then the next one's misogynist. anybody else? Okay.
What would you say is your favourite Disney Channel original movie from the mid-2000s?
I didn't really watch much Disney Channel. Oh wait, what was that one? Princess Protection Program?
Yes!
Yeah, that one actually. Okay. Kira.
So, considering that the holiday of drunkenness is coming up, What is your favourite drink and what are you going to, where are you going to go and we're doing some happy tonight?
Okay, right, well, I've got the IV on the weekend, so a lot of it is going to be spent me trying to converse with Southerners. And then I also have to take two Liverpool people to my house. I also have to go to Portland alone to get an air mattress. And then I'm going to go and hop around multiple bars in Belfast, finding people that I know. And favourite drink, kind of like vodka Red Bull.
I would like to ask for permission to ask our dear guest chair and President Emeritus a question. So, in your time in the Literific, I've actually asked specifically, how did your presidency come to an end?
You don't have to take
this. Oh my god. By no means, do you have to.
I guess it'll be worse whatever you're doing.
Well,
well,
in the peaceful transfer of power from one democratic leader.
Okay, Terrence?
Earlier this week, actually on the Ides of Mark and the March, I filled in with two other members of the esteemed society and made the mistake of inviting them for free drink. At which point I was accosted, pushed up against the wall, and asked if I condemned the French. I would like to tentatively offer a referral. I know we do this every day, but I would have thought the Republicans among us, the French aren't so bad. They did after all. Behead a king. However, I would like to amend our thing that we don't condemn the French en masse, particularly focus our attentions on Parisians.
I know that you want me to do that, but I will be cooed if I don't condemn the French.
Here, my French friends would try.
Instead of condemning them, will you rebuke the French?
And if you do that, there's a thesis about that. So.
Do you want me to rebuke the French?
Rebuke Parisians! I think that's a good middle ground. No, you haven't been to Paris. No.
Okay, I rebuke the French.
Yeah!
Any other questions?
That actually falls under one of my other theses. Cultural appropriation, and I'd ask that you do not stay in my debt.
I won't steal your bit. Any other president's questions? I'll go to Noah.
I'd like to ask our guest chair a question. Do you also do that in the French?
You don't have to do this.
My views on the French are, like my views on the Reformation, a secret that will be closely held.
Watch
out.
Not to sort of ask anything else into politics that matter. Were you happy with the results of the ASU election?
What do I feel about them?
Like, any comments you'd like to make about
them? It doesn't really matter at the end of the day. Nothing's going to change. I'll take one more question.
Can I clarify something?
Oh god.
Terrence, we did not push you up against the wall. It was free wine and free cheese. The wine turned out to be awful, so the reason we were staying around was simply because of your stimulating conversation. So I would like to clarify that me and Jack are not guilty of this horrendous allegation.
There we go.
Okay, and as a judge, I guess I rule in your favour. Okay, before we invite...
Please stop, I can't even sit
this. If the 5 minutes are up. So before we invite Andrew Crovers up to give some words, I'd like to have a vote of prior opinion so that he can't sway you one way or the other. So if you do regret the Reformation, please put your hand up and say, I know.
What's that?
Five.
Five.
And if you oppose the motion tonight,
no,
so you don't regret the reformation, please put your hand up now. Okay. I got 20.
Say 17.
Okay. And if you have no opinion on tonight's motion, or you just can't make up your mind, okay.
For monster. You're planning to choose when it comes to
I got 14.
14.
So, after every question, there was a vote prior. Anyhow, there were 5 votes for I, 17 votes for nay, 14 Alliance voters. So either proposition, opposition has it, sadly.
Robert's up to give some words on the record.
Madam President, members of the House, thank you very much for this very kind invitation that you've extended to me to come along and chair this evening's debate. I think for any visitors in the room, you know what you're letting yourselves in for by now, so the door's that way, and I promise I won't be offended if you get up and go. This is a motion that has a great deal of personal interest for me. Although I studied history here at Queen's, I'm now a theology postgraduate at Durham University, and I'm also exploring a vocation to ordain ministry in the Church of England. So this is something that is of a great deal of personal interest. I think a small observation about that particular denomination helps to set the scene for this evening's debate. One eminent historian wrote that the Church of England is composed of 3 groups, 3 parties. Those who wish to complete the work of the Reformation, those who wish to complete the work of the Counter-Reformation, and those who wish to complete the work of the Enlightenment. I think that's what passes for a joke in academic circles. I'm not quite sure. But it illustrates something very important about the contested legacy of this historical process. Within this one nominally Protestant denomination, we find this broad spectrum of views of those who are, with apologies to our rad-trad friend at the table, more Catholic than the Catholics. And those... alongside those who would condemn their brothers in faith for blasphemy. So we have just within that one denomination a breadth of opinion and perspectives on this event, which I think gives the motion a bit of meat and a bit of bite for everyone to get their teeth into this evening. So before I hand over to kick things off this evening, I just have one final observation to make. Whenever I told a colleague that I was coming back to chair this debate and explain to him what the motion was, he was utterly astonished. This English colleague of mine couldn't believe that a university society in this society of all was inviting so much trouble on itself by debating this motion. And I think that that demonstrates something of the value of this organisation as a forum for the polite, if slightly chaotic, discussion of... We done? Thank you very much. As a forum for the discussion of sensitive issues of great interest to this province and this city and this university. So, after 10 years out in the wilderness, it's a delight to be back. It's a delight to see that you're continuing to fight the good fight of facing up to the hard issues, and I look forward to seeing what our speakers have in store. So, thank you very much.
Yeah, so I'd just like to go through the rules of the debate. Yeah. So each speech only lasts for 7 minutes. The first and last minute is protected time, meaning nobody can POI you. And when I ring the bell, that'll be the end of protected time. And then when I ring the bell again, that is when protected time starts again. When you POI, please do not barrack, so wait 15 seconds between each POI before you POI again, and only make sure your POIs last no more than 10 seconds. That is everything, so I'd like to welcome Eleanor Robbins to open the proposition. Made a speech of this horrific, which is why a regretful thing that happened there. I'd just like to open my speech saying that it would be really easy for me to sort of kind of waffle about religion and the religious aspects of regretting or not regretting the Reformation. I personally don't have, you know, a dollar in that fight. I am an Oriental Orthodox Christian and don't have much to do with these post-Chalcedonian heretics. But I would like to like talk about iconoclasm and what the amount of sorry, I'm just a bit nervous. The amount of artifacts and manuscripts which were destroyed during the Reformation, and you know, how that was indeed quite a regretful happening. Now the many historians, well, we have to kind of establish the role of monks as historians, custodians, and record keepers of kind of medieval Western Europe. So, obviously, when the Reformation came along and the monasteries were systematically destroyed, that also came along with the destruction of thousands of medieval manuscripts, artifacts, stained glass windows, architecture, which are now permanently lost to us today. Now, this was very much a systemic effort. Gustav I of Sweden passed many acts, you know, creating the destruction of monastic buildings and texts. And Edward VI kind of did the same thing in 1551, insisting on destruction of superstitious books. Now, what is a superstitious book? We don't know, because they're all lost to us. The kind of scars and wheels of the Reformation and the destruction of pre-Reformation architecture in books are actually carved across our landscape. In England, we have Crowland, Croxton, Dale, many destroyed monasteries which were host a lot to particular libraries. Now, it's kind of like a difficult topic to talk about, because we sort of end up talking about a lot about hypotheticals. What could have been? What could have been kind of saved? What could have been lost? And like, we do get kind of little tidbits of it. We find pages of manuscripts covered in excrement that have been used to kind of wipe bottoms, that have been that have been used to as part of kind of building, to plaster walls. And some of these kind of texts are fragmentary, but still very significant. Lots of Anglo-Saxon poetry has been sort of burned as kind of Reformation activity. And when we look to kind of places which didn't have a Reformation, like Italy, they have lots of these medieval manuscripts intact and a very rich kind of medieval literature, which, early medieval literature, which we'd in, well, kind of post-Reformation countries like England, Sweden, Denmark, don't actually have access to, because we've essentially destroyed our own culture. In terms of the destruction of libraries, this didn't actually happen just during kind of the main Reformation period, circa like 1551, Gustav I of Sweden. It actually kind of had long-term effects. So we kind of get things like the English Civil War, which arguably would not have happened if it weren't for you know, Catholic Protestant tension within England. And the Roundheads, actually parliamentarians, came into Wales and they destroyed Raglan Library, which was host to basically all of medieval Welsh literature. Now, there's only, I think, maybe five or six, seven kind of main poetic Welsh texts left. There's a library full of it, which was destroyed by parliamentarians in kind of Reformation-caused conflict. So, yeah, that's a whole nation's literature and culture which has been lost to us because of the Reformation as a direct cause of it. You know, this is not accounting for the stained glass windows. I believe Our Lady of the Church of Our Lady in Antwerp has an engraving of them smashing all the windows, of stealing all the silver, which went back to the early Medieval period, the late kind of Roman period, which has now kind of been melted down, lost. So it's a great kind of cultural tragedy akin to the burning of the Library of Alexandria that we're looking at for Western Europe, and it's a loss to the entire world. Now, there are some counter-arguments which one could sort of posit me, which I'm going to tackle in advance. which is, who cares? Like, who cares, you know? Maybe who cares about all this stuff? And I feel like that if you think that, then that's kind of your problem. Because if you're pro book burning, I feel like you kind of sit down and think about your values for a minute. And also kind of there's an argument that it would have happened anyway. So you kind of, in France, you get lots of similar kind of stuff happening. There was never a formal Reformation in France, even though there was Reformation activity. But the French Revolution, you know, they similarly burned lots of manuscripts, burned through lots of medieval kind of material. But kind of the thing is that it kind of wouldn't have happened anyway. Like, just because, yes, tension did bubble up eventually with the Catholic Church in kind of Catholic majority countries, doesn't necessarily mean it was, oh, I'm so sorry, inevitable. Inevitable, the French still have plenty more like medieval and pre-Reformation manuscripts than we do in England. So, and also, kind of, one might make the argument that if it weren't for the Reformation happening in the violent manner in which it did, the Catholic Church actually would have moved on. But again, I'm talking about hypotheticals, and I feel like that highlights that in itself, while it could be construed as a weakness to my argument, is actually highlighting the tragedy of what happened. Like, we won't know. We won't have those records. They're entirely lost to us. They're destroyed. They're covered in human excrement and urine and in wounds and used for kind of aristocrats' lampshades. So, So I think I'd like to open this debate by mourning the cultural loss which the Reformation caused.
Chair, Madam President, members of the House, it's wonderful to be back here at the Literific, and I want to thank Eleanor for kicking us off tonight. Just to get straight in to what you mentioned, I agree there was tragedies committed on the side of the Reformation, but we both burnt each other. The Roman Catholic Church burnt plenty of our reformers. Tyndale, who translated the Bible into English, was burnt at the stake. Plenty of people who believed the Reformation truce were killed. This is meant to be protected, look. But anyway. But just to provide a bit of context, I understand most people voted. They don't really care about the Reformation. What's it got to do with us? We're 21st century people, Western people. We don't need to talk about some religious dispute 500 years ago. But I want us to paint the picture of what it was like. Imagine you're in the 16th century, 15th century, growing up. Life expectancy's what, like 30, if you're lucky? I mean, you're gonna probably, as soon as you could walk, as soon as you could talk, you were out in the fields farming for your family to get enough food to feed yourself, and if you're blessed, your relatives. And your only hope in this life of pain was this talk of eternal bliss that some man in the big church was telling you about. You had this hope that you clung to, this eternal bliss. That was what your hope, your comfort in this life came, and you listened to what the man said because you'd know all the alternative. Everyone listened to him. You had to take in what he was saying. And one day this man comes and he says, look, if you give us money for these indulgences, you'll skip through purgatory. You'll or as Johann Tetzel, sorry, I'll return in a minute, as Johann Tetzel, the chief proponent of the indulgences, which the Catholic Church instituted in the 1500s, said, as soon as the coin on the copper rings, the soul from purgatory springs. That's what he was telling you. That's what he was telling us. And let me just finish the story. So now you are labouring not only to get money to feed your family, but you are labouring to secure eternal hope, to pay for it. Yes, sorry.
Right, you're talking about indulgences, but wasn't a widespread kind of thing about the Catholic Church at the time? Really, the Pope was trying to curb it at the time. Also, you're completely ignoring the fact
That's historically untrue. Pope Leo decreed it to ensure he could pay for the Vatican being painted by, what do you call Michelangelo, was that his name? That is literally what happened. He instituted it to pay for the extravagance of the Roman Catholic Church. That's what happened.
I was making points about paying to kind of go to heaven. I kind of see parallels in modern kind of prospect groups as televangelists.
I know I'm talking about post-op too.
Give me money. Yeah.
I totally agree. I'm opposed to that. But I think it's important to recognise the Reformation, why it came about. We were trying to reform the church back to the basics, back to the New Testament doctrine, back to the early church. We were trying to get rid of the shackles of man-made religion and get back to the religion instituted by the Holy Scriptures in God's Word. But, like I said, I understand. You maybe don't have a faith here. You maybe don't care too much. But I would say the very fact that we're here using reason, using debate, without fear of getting burnt at the stake, is downwind from the Reformation. No one dared speak up against the Roman Catholic Church back then. They had all the ecclesiastical courts against you. They had all the power in the world. So no one dared raise their voice until Luther banged those 95 theses against the door of Wittenberg. Sorry, I'll...
Did many Protestant kings and queens not go about then burning plenty of Catholics for daring to speak out against Protestant theology?
I mean, there were crimes. No, here, hold on a second. Look, there were crimes on both sides. Hold on a second. No, my people are not my people, but. Sorry. The Presbyterians, which is the denomination I belong to, were killed by Anglicans as well. So, yeah, I regret all of that. Like, you know, I don't think that's good. But what I'm saying is, the elevation of logic and reason, which the Reformation brought, the fact that it spread the truth that we are made in the image of God, blessed with reason to articulate and to debate the scriptures, that's what the Reformation brought. And it brought us the elevation to be able to discern what scriptures meant. Sorry, I'm going to flow 1 second. And the main wonderful truth is back then, no one knew what the Bible said. No one had a clue. It was in Latin. No one spoke Latin. The common people couldn't understand. So what did the reformers do? They worked and labored to translate from Latin into the language of the peoples, into Irish, into English, into French, into German, so that people could understand what the scriptures said.
Yeah, I completely understand that it gave like a spiritual education, but it also led to the closing of many convents, which meant that a lot of women had no opportunity for education and had a desperate impact on women in that year.
Well, it opened up education, because for you to get educated as a woman, then you had to be a nun. You know, you couldn't just go to school. Whereas the Reformation brought schools. The whole reason why we wanted to educate the poor, for example, in Scotland, was because we believed, right, most important of all is for people to be able to read so that they could understand what God has revealed in His Word. So we wanted to spread education to left, right, and centre to everyone so they could understand what the Scripture said. Look.
Nothing bad ever happened in religious schools, no?
I think you've more of an issue there, Bena. I don't want this to get into control of abuse. But look, like I said, look, yes, I didn't get on to how it led to modern political theory, how it led to the explosion of scientific theory, but primarily it was spiritual issue. It told us that it doesn't matter, it recovered the wonderful truth that what makes us right before our Creator is not by how many rosaries we say, not by how much money we give to the indulgences, not by how many masses we partake in, but we can be right with God through faith in His Son, the Lord Jesus, that it's not on what I can do, but it's on what He has done for us. And that's the truth that was recovered in the Reformation. And that's the truth that spread all across Europe and has spread in this day across every tribe, tongue and nation. So that's why we should vote to oppose the motion.
Popular demand.
I want you to keep in mind one question as I speak. What do I desire?
The Reformation and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race. Now, it's no secret that the Catholic Church is heavily flawed, though I do love it. The Protestant's response to this was not to come together and let's sort out these issues, was to run, flee, hide, sow chaos, disorder, and disunity. This does not fix any problems. That was during the Reformation. Of course there were problems. So this was not the true motivation of the Reformation. The true motivation of the Reformation was one thing. Vanity, vanity, all they offer you is vanity. And what exactly do I mean? I mean idealistic egoism. I mean to separate you from meaningful relationships. And I mean, thirdly, to make you crave power and control. No. Now, what is your ego? Your ego is just something you consciously think you are. It's an idea, a concept, it's an illusion. It's small, it's limited, it's crude. And since the Reformation, we in the West have become so psychologically perverse that many of us would rather be an idea of ourselves than to truly get with yourself. Now, how might you get with yourself? Through committed, embedded relationships in a community. Your identity must, well, you should, nothing must be, but you should. You should socially negotiate your identity, as Jean Piaget did say. But the reformers would have you self-assert your identity. The reason being, I am that I am. They are godless self-gods. This rips any chance of meaning from your relationship because it makes your relationships competitive with yourself and one another.
On that point?
Yes, my dear.
But I do want to pin down that point about vanity, which sort of that stems from. But I do want to pinpoint the vanity point. The point he made was that there was this sale of indulgences and things like that. I encourage you to address that because that's lingering in my mind. Surely that's a manifestation of vanity and ego within the Catholic Church.
Yeah, no, 110%. And that is why the Catholic Church has a great tradition in history of many synods, meetings to solve these sorts of problems, of which they did later on. So again, that did. The actual reason of solving that problem of indulgences was not a motivation of them. It was simply a faux reason. So it was just to promote power. So what does this sort of ripping the meaning out of your relationships do? It disorders the way you think. It prevents you from being truly sane. Sanity is not something that individual can possess. Sanity is something that happens when you have all these different relationships with many, many people throughout your life. In your community, and is the harmony between them towards a certain goal. But as they rip this necessary meaning from your relationships, they ensure you have a disordered way of thinking. They force this confrontation between your relationships with others. This will make you thirst for power and control, because once you come into any form of conflict with anybody close to you, you will have to assert that I am right, my interpretation is right, because I know best. Say you could control everyone, that you had that sort of power, what would you want to do with it? I think if you think really deeply, you don't know what you want to do with it. I would argue even that you get to, metaphorically, hell as a result of not knowing what you really want. Thoughtless pursuit of ego. We do not want that. I don't believe anybody wants that. Nobody wants to play at being God.
On that one?
Yes.
I quite like that name.
Well, thank God, you're not the example for everybody. You're you. Now, again, I'll ask the question, what do I desire? The same question as what, who am I? You have two options. You have reasons. They would have you self-assert an ego, an idea of yourself that no one can challenge you on because no one has more authority over you than you.
Quite a repression.
Yes.
That's not what we're saying whatsoever.
That is the cause of the Reformation. Again, if this was about, let's debate the theological points of different branches of Protestantism, fine, but it's not, it's about a Reformation, it's about consequences.
About Reformation?
No. This, again, destroys your ability to love and have relationships. It promotes your drive for power and dominance. Or you have another option. Pope Fra.
On that point.
Yes.
Surely by writing to the top of the Catholic Church and going through the structures to do so, Pope Francis showed his desire for power and monarchy?
No, not at all. I think Pope Francis is a... First of all, he's beautiful. Because I think that he assumes the responsibility for many, many people, though he is a very old and sick man. Because he takes on many responsibilities that most people would never dare in their life. Possibly you're excluded from this. But no, I wouldn't say that having one of the most stressful jobs in the world, controlling the... forwarding the world's largest religion is something that you would do for selfish reasons. You'll just become a banker. Now you have a second option. Us. You can answer what do I desire and who am I with, I don't truly know. There's two parts to this. You don't truly know because you already have it. And the second part is you can never truly know yourself. You're an endless mystery to yourself. So stop clinging to this idea of yourself and start actually experiencing life instead of going about saying, I am this, I believe this, I faith alone, this, that, bomb, bomb, bomb. All these idiocies. All this egotistical nonsense. And actually, just come into communion with a community that is there for you, and you are part of it as equally as it is part of you. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Speaker, members of the House. So, we'd just like to start off my speech by making a few rebuttals to that previous speech in Westminster Hall.
Good luck.
Yes, thank you very much. So, first of all, on the thing that, on your point, if I get it right, that the Reformation, as the last speaker said, was something about asserting our own vanity, I would like to say that one of the key ideas behind the Reformation was not just obviously this idea of faith alone, but we'd like to add in the idea of grace alone, and that Luther and the other reformers asserted that as Christians, those of us who believe, we are saved by faith alone through grace alone, and that there's nothing we can do to come to God, so it's not vanity, yes. Okay, yes, please. I'll take it. Yes,
Wait,
Luke.
Specifically, what is faith/belief?
So, it's believing. You've just opened a good chance for me. I have, and it's faith that we know that God loves us, that we are saved, that we're saved by God, and that, and we know God.
Circular.
Okay, yes. Wow. Yes. So, yeah, just wanted to get that out of the way. And, yes, the rest of my speech will be actually focusing actually beyond this idea that, yes, the Reformation, while at its heart, it was a theological controversy, we can't deny it. And someone who studied theology for my undergrad, I should know that. But also,
The Reformation, as we know it, also helped to create the modern world as we know it today. And for one thing, yes?
Is that necessarily a good thing?
Get into that. And then, yes. And because actually, far from creating like a confined, forcing people to believe in God, Luther's idea that we should everyone, one of Luther's mates' ideas was obviously the fact that, as my previous colleague has said, that the Bible should be translated into every language, and as part of that, that gave everyone in Europe and now the world the chance to read the Bible for themselves and to make their own decision about God. And yes.
That was not Luther's point at all. He literally thought in like a one unifying faith. He thought if he translated it, everyone would believe the same thing. It didn't, and also led to a bastardization of the faith where essentially people used it to gain power instead of actually believing in God.
Yes.
Also, the Catholic Church was responsible for lots of religious poetry. So although they might have not actually had direct access to the Bible, they did have direct access to kind of faithful poetry, religious poetry, which appropriated kind of Bible verses and communicated the same things. So he did know what was going on.
I would argue how much they understood it, but that's another thing. And also I would point out that, as another speaker had mentioned, how claiming the Reformation was responsible for a great cultural loss, that in reality I would also say that, yes, while there was some unfortunate iconoclasm on the part of not necessarily even the reformers, but the populist outrage that followed them, that kind of thing is also seen in secular events like the French Revolution. So I would say that just shows that human nature to an extent. And I would also say, and continuing on from that, actually, another important part of the Reformation and the main focus of my speech is how the Reformation actually paved the way for the modern conception of Europe itself as nation-states, and how Luther, in writing his diatribe against indulgences and the papacy, was not just making theological argument, but as Luther said in one of his letters, that the problem with indulgences was not just that they gave a false idea of how one could be saved, but also that they were sending German money across the Alps into Rome for the benefit of Rome. So yeah, basically it was asserting the German nationalism and protecting German interests against a European hierarchy introducing like the papacy, which I think we all know was replicated in England with Henry VIII and the English Reformation, which actually initially had nothing or little to do with theological differences, and indeed Henry VIII actually remained a staunch opponent of Luther and his ideas until the day he died, but used it as a way of asserting England's independence from the papacy and almost as a way of taking back control, which, where have we sure heard that before? I would just also point out there that when his Catholic daughter Mary came to the throne, the last thing she wanted was to return that power to the papacy. So even when a Catholic did get back into control of England, we didn't see that reversing. So yeah, I would just say, yeah, if you like the way we have now have freedom to believe now, and yeah, I'm just saying vote with the opposition. Thank you.
Right, so I think a big aspect of the debate tonight that's been missed is essentially something that my comrade actually looked up. which is power, and ultimately who should have it, the church or the monarchy? And that's essentially what this debate boils down to, because a lot of talk has been given to indulgences tonight, right? And I'm gonna actually kind of compare both sides here, because what the other side ignores is, yes, there was corruption in the Catholic Church, but a lot of indulgences, like money from the indulgences, was actually used in charitable efforts to help the poor, like with hospitals and giving out food to those who are impoverished, right? And yes, some of that money went into the hands of people who it shouldn't have, but a lot of money from indulgences was used in the Christian way, essentially helping the poor and trying to essentially advance them. And the Reformation basically killed all this off. Why did it do it? Because essentially what happened with the Reformation is it gave permission for basically monarchs and things like that to reject the power of the Catholic Church. And what this meant was that monarchs, instead of having to essentially listen to the Catholic Church, they went, screw you, we're going to take everything you have. For my own part, not for religious reasons, not for any good on their own part. We're going to take it because it'll fuel our wars, our own coffers, and it's not going to help any of the peasantry, really, is it? And that's ultimately what happened. It went from an organisation that, fair enough, was not doing everything great with the money, but was doing some good with the money, to the monarchs, who are doing nothing good with it.
On that point.
Nope. And essentially, there's been a lot of talk here tonight about how the Reformation led to basically this democratisation of faith. Essentially, oh yeah, we can take it back in our own hands. Intention is very different from actually what happened. And that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. Because the intention was, yes, to democratise the faith and we all unite under this one faith. The reality was very different because, again, monarchs like power. And what do? They use religion to get more power. And this led of this, and it meant that essentially monarchs could essentially go, oh, this is my interpretation of the Bible, this is my interpretation of these teaching, and basically use it to justify some awful, awful things. No, because, for example, it was used by Henry VIII, where he was like, oh, I'm a Protestant now, I'm going away from the Catholic Church, to basically promote something which is inherently unreligious, which is divorce. It also led to several monarchs essentially using it to butcher, maim, and burn anyone who didn't agree with their policies. And claimed that it was because of religion. Yes, go for it. No. What I'm saying is, essentially, this debate is ultimately about what's worse. What I'm saying is, with the Catholic Church, at least they were doing something kind of, albeit good, with the money. But then it all pretty much went to the... No, and pretty much... Let me finish the bloody PY. Anyway. And they essentially went to the monarchs, who used it to essentially fund wars. And as my first speaker said, basically rip all the cultural and historical heritage to shreds to fund their own efforts and their own power. And they also used it to essentially advance their... They used religion and they changed their religious doctrine to suit their needs and to basically get rid of their opponents by saying, oh, they're Protestants, they're not Catholics, they don't believe in the true faith, let's X all of them. And that's... What the other side is completely ignoring as well, they're saying that led to this idea of Europe, completely ignoring the fact that it decimated Europe for absolutely centuries. Have you heard of the 30 Years' War? Or any sort of religious conflict that happened? Essentially, the Reformation led to essentially this separation along religious lines throughout the entirety of Europe, which led to a lot of wars. A lot of wars that basically led to absolutely devastating impacts. Like, for example, I'm not taking any more POIs, I'm doing a historical debate. And essentially, like, for example, the 30 Years' War, which was fought on religious lines, where essentially 8 billion people died. Billion. And I'm also not counting, deaths that have essentially happened along religious lines over the centuries since the Reformation. And what we're saying is you have to choose whether to allow that.
Yeah. Did you just say a billion people died?
No, it wasn't a billion. It was roughly 4 billion to 8 billion, I think.
8 billion?
Yes, roughly.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no worries. I believe that's the correct figure.
Was it?
It's 4 to 8 billion died during the 30 years.
Sorry,
I misspoke. That's my bad. But essentially, history debates, it's fun, but my point still stands. Basically, religious division across essentially the continent has led to several deaths and several people using religion and basically twisting it to gain their own power and influence, which is something that we should regret. Thank you very much.
Mr. President, Madam President, Buddy Holly, I apologise, this is going to be slightly higgledy-piggledy as I wrote this on the march. First of all, beginning with some rebuttals, Eleanor, your speech, the whole thing about architecture and works and things like that, I mean, fair enough, you sort of have to decide whether the good outweighs the bad in terms of people being able to come out from under the thumb of the Catholic Church. And I mean, it was the Middle Ages. It wasn't exactly, no matter what Kira paints it as some sort of utopia, it wasn't a very peaceful place. Anytime anything happened, they burned everything to the ground. And, you know, it was very Northern Irish. And it's, we know about quite a lot. Peter has given me something that I cannot read, so I will have to ignore it. Need to take some sort of handwriting lesson. Luke, my dear Luke. My sweet one. What on earth can I say to Luke about his particular argument? His argument seemed to stand on the basis that the concept of free grace alone, seemed to be some sort of revolutionary theory within the church. Given the fact that it is in the book of Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8 to 9 says, For by grace are ye saved through faith. I'm in the middle of reading from the Bible. Anyway, for by grace are ye saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not by works, lest any man should boast. Yes, it's King James, we're not going to see you now. go on. What?
Faith without works is dead.
Yes. Mm-hmm. the context of that particular verse seems to be more that faith should enable good works, not that you are saved in any way by good works, which is exactly what this verse attests to. Isn't Paul wrote this? I don't know who wrote this. Anyway, so you seem to be establishing that this is some sort of revolutionary thing that Luther came up with, grace alone. It's some sort of heresy that needs to be gotten rid of. I can see Kira's face is going very strange with this concept. But that's what I would say to yourself. And the whole thing about ego, that the Reformation was driven by ego, following the teachings of Jesus the way he wanted them, rather than some big, very, very rich men in funny hats who have their own vested interest. I would say that was probably less egotistic than the ones setting the rules in the first place. Now, Kira. Kira. The idyllic utopia of the early medieval period that Kira paints some of you may be surprised that wasn't actually real. The Crusades, for instance, it was not a tea party. It was a religious conflict that involved many, many deaths. And I suppose that brings me back to what you were saying about the destruction of architecture and poetry and stuff like that. The Crusades happened, they went in, burnt everybody, killed everybody, everything that was there. No, go away.
Where was I?
Yes, the Crusades. Ah, wonderful. Also her argument that it was either supporting the church financially or the monarchy financially. I would say that before the Reformation, it was both of them. It wasn't a choice of one or the other. It was getting yourself out from the thumb of one. Yes, obviously it would take a while longer for the monarchy to stop being an absolute power. But before the Reformation, it wasn't just the church. You also had to give money to the government through taxes and things like that to fund these wars and things like that. It wasn't just Protestant monarchs that did that. In fact, you could argue that the medieval period it did bring about a lot more peace after the Reformation than before it. Things like the Hundred Years' War, Agincourt, all that sort of stuff. Although that was against the French, so I think that was just right. So the point is here, yes, and her other argument about indulgences going to Christian purposes. Whatever your definition of Christian purposes is, as Peter has touched on, they were brought about, they were there before, but they were brought about in much part by Pope Leo in order to build St. Peter's. Now, I've been to St. Peter's. It's very, very nice, but I don't think it should be built on the backs of people starving in medieval feudal Europe.
It's the difference between some of the money going to the fair and all of the money not going, but basically going towards something else. That's the difference here.
Yes, well, of course. Once the Reformation came about, no money went to the poor through Lutheranism or any of the other Reformation thoughts. Of course, Protestant churches now give nothing to charities, and we hate the poor. We hate the poor completely, of course. Obviously, that's a joke for other Protestants. I do hate the poor. What? Yes, the wee dairy man. Well, any reason I give is going to be less controversial than Aidan, so I'll just... I don't know. I just have something against them.
On that point...
If you must.
I love you, Sam. Not
the Gaelic. Oh, dear. Guide me, O thou great Jehovah. So a bit of context after I've... established what nonsense is coming out of these people's mouths. A bit of context, I suppose we're talking about Europe and France, which is a completely alien place to us, of course, even back in the Middle Ages. Before the Reformation, I'd like to talk about the Suppression of Heresy Act of 1414, which was enacted in England under Henry V. Now, it pains me to criticise Henry V, because he did absolutely wallop the French, but... What I have to say is this made it a crime to read the Bible in English, and what it actually said was the text of this, not all of it because it was a long time, or a very long document. It said that whoever should read the scriptures in English should forfeit land, cattle, goods, and life, to be condemned as heretics to God, enemies of the crown, and traitors to the kingdom. If they continued abstinent or relapsed after pardon, they should be hanged for treason against the king. I know James would probably consider this quite moderate, but is it plenty time already? Oh, jeepers, I better hurry up. Yes, so this was the context before, and I'd say that anything that got them under the thumb of this, or out of under the thumb of this, and towards making up your own mind, is for the good. And I'd like to conclude with my argument that I thought I would have slightly more time to argue, 30 seconds, was that the main... reason for the Reformation, I think, was definitely the invention of the printing press, which put the Bible into the hands of people who wanted to read it rather than being told what it says by the church. I'll say thank you and goodbye.
For a great speech, and now we'll move on to a round of questions. So if anybody has a question for the proposition. Yes, you do.
So it's a this house regrets motion.
Yes.
Now, as Kira's way likes to point out in a this house regrets motion, the proposition is to point out a world in which we have regretted this, whatever it is. So in this case we should point out a world in which the Reformation did not happen.
The proposition did not do so. Can you please do so?
Right, so essentially in a world without the Reformation, we would have much more essentially of our culture there, essentially in the fact that we would have a lot more kind of
earnings.
A lot more kind of works from that time that we could share today. And essentially a second thing that we wouldn't have had the Reformation basically not happened was essentially a lot of wars fought along religious divide, essentially. And the third thing as well, which I'd like to point out, is the fact that they've argued that essentially this whole thing kind of, Luther helped kind of spread like the Bible across the world and things like that, and that led to increased literacy and things like that. But that's completely ignoring the fact that the printing press happened before Luther, and that's completely ignoring the fact that someone else other than Luther was going to abuse the printing press at some point and did the exact same thing he did, which would have had the exact same result. Thank you.
Opposite to respond.
You go ahead. I think, again, a world where the Reformation didn't happen, it's ultimately it was a spiritual, theological dispute. And the motto of the Reformation was post tenebris lux in Latin, which means after darkness comes light. And I would say it would be only inevitable that the light of the truth of the gospel which was recovered would burst forth. So a world without the Reformation, it was going to happen at some stage, because you couldn't keep the truth of God's word under a bushel for long enough. It would shine, it would burst forth, and that's why we are here today.
Any questions for the opposition? Resident Emeritus of that.
Particularly painted at your first speaker. So you claim enlightenment and progress, and that's what you claim fundamentally in your speech, is that this was a sort of, we're wiping the slate clean and we're going back to exactly what the fundamental principles of all of this and then it proceeded to take the form of something that you accepted yourself was pretty much just two people burning one another continuously and extensive amounts of damage to, you know, how many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of lives. Now, if that enlightenment came in that form, how can you really justify the Reformation in the form that you are trying to defend, if when it manifested in pretty much a way that's no better, I'm not offending you, but pretty much it's no better than ever?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the question, but how I would answer that is by saying that those people who went and burnt their enemies on both sides were acting contrary to the Reformation truths of what's revealed in the Word. So the people on the Reformation side who were killing others weren't actually acting in alignment with the truths of which they professed. So I find it deeply regrettable too.
And if I can, just as a point of clarification,
yeah.
So neither were the individuals who restrained from what God on this side.
Well, but the issue is truth. Who was proclaiming the truth? If truth can be known, then we all have a nature of moving towards that truth. And if we have an objective standard of truth, which we fought and died for to keep, and that's how we compare.
Proposition. Right.
This is the point I was trying to understand. This is the point I was trying to make about ego, power, all these sorts of things. They don't actually care about truth, they care about specific interpretations of these things. They do not care about objective, universal truths, they care about their interpretation. One of the reasons they are so pro-Reformation is because they think the Reformation only has one branch. The Reformation is not one branch. The Reformation is a second Tower of Babel situation. Or a thousand different branches, in case you didn't know of them. There's lots of Protestants. Lots of different kinds of Protestants, and they all hate each other almost as much as they hate me. If you think you represent the entirety of the Reformation, you are always the reason I said the Reformation and its consequences have been a disaster. You missed.
Any abstaining questions? A question from either side, just something you want to ask? I'll go to Ryan.
I've come to this, and I'm historically ignorant, and I don't know. What is the Reformation?
I use both have to do it by rules, so
yeah.
Opposition first, what's the Reformation?
Oh my god!
Right, I learned how to make
them. No better than us.
Reformation is. The Reformation was a recovery of biblical truth and was a recovery of the Bible into the hands of the noble people. But that led to lots of cultural situations that spread across Europe.
Okay.
That's probably what I was saying.
And what the proposition I think the Reformation is?
The Reformation was a period in which nations essentially, or groups in Western Europe, rejected the Catholic Church en masse and decided to go and do their own thing en masse, which unleashed havoc for the 500 years and it's the way.
Right, I'd like to welcome up Andrew Crubbers to give some closing remarks before we take over.
Well, thank you very much, everybody, for a very stimulating and enlightening period of discussion. I think if it's all right with the president, I'd just have a couple of observations that I'd like to make about what we've heard this evening, about some of the things also that we haven't heard this evening. I think if I could just make a couple of observations about private members' business, I would say thank heavens we didn't get all 95 of the theses, although it did feel like it at times. To the point about nuclear weapons, I'm glad to see that the Rad-Trad's grasp of Catholic theology is about as poor as we expect from that group. Given that this is a church that formally considers nuclear weapons as a blasphemy. I think there were some contributions regarding members of the society that I'm not familiar with, something to do with Mrs. Beaver, I don't know who that is, so I don't feel qualified to comment. On President's questions, I think vodka Red Bull being the drink of the present should be added to the theses. So, on to the actual subject of the debate. I just have a few observations about each of the speakers. I'll try not to go on for too long. Eleanor Robbins, congratulations on a very fine maiden speech. I think you hit the nail on the head with the point about iconoclasm. I think as a historian by training, that's a deeply lamentable period in human history, and as someone who makes a habit of going to old churches when I'm on holiday and seeing faces gouged from statues and frescoes that have been whitewashed over. It is a deeply distressing thing that the Reformation and the inheritors of the Reformation need to grapple with. And I don't know that we really heard a firm engagement with that from the opposition this evening. One point I would say that you could also have considered was there is a great deal of evidence of a broadening of literacy as a result of the Reformation. The genie was let out of the bottle by the Reformation, and I think that's also something that we need to factor in. Peter Hutchinson, congratulations on a very fine sermon. I think if you really wanted to sermonise in the Presbyterian tradition, you should do it extemporaneously and without notes, though, next time. I'm always going to be in favour of a speech that values historical processes today and tries to argue the case for relevance. I'd be careful of the back to basics argument with the reformers. I think there's a degree of scepticism about that in the historical literature of the Reformation these days. And I think, and this was a point several speakers made on the opposition, the idea that the Reformation was a sort of paradise of free thought, of liberation to think your thoughts and speak your mind. And I don't really think that's supported by any of the evidence. If you read Luther's famous tract on princes' duties towards rebellious peasants, and the summation of that seems to be burn them all, I don't think we can really consistently argue that the reformers had a very liberal attitude to free thought and free expression. Although you could argue, and this is something I think the proposition failed to fully engage with, that the Reformation helped to let that genie out of the bottle. I think to Luke Maguire's speech, I think your argument about the Reformation as a process of deracination and atomization is a very interesting one. Although I would point you to the work of many Protestant theologians who write a great deal about the value of community. Rowan Williams, for example, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, who writes that identity is entirely constituted in our relationships. It's meaningless to ask, what does it mean to be a person? All we can ask is, what does it mean to be this person with these relationships and this historical context? So it's not just yours. That's all I'll say on that one. John McClintock, again, a very fine speech talking about the value of reform in creating the modern world, particularly the modern consensus around nation state. Although I think it's a fair question to ask, is the modern world a good thing? I must confess, I was intrigued by your argument that the creation of a strong German national identity. So that's just one thing to consider, perhaps. Keir Swale, again, very fine speech. And the consideration of the Weberian Protestant ethic versus a Catholic social ethic, religion as a check on the selfish misuse of material goods, is a very fair and a very reasonable point. Although, again, my question would be, was it the reformers' intention to democratize faith? You argue that it was. And I'm not so sure that it was. I think you could argue that the Reformation was, in fact, even worse than you had indicated in your speech. And finally, Sam Hazlitt, a very fine speech as well. Very witty and a very commanding speech, if I may say. I would just say that Protestants have their own share of funny hats, speaking as someone who's raised a Presbyterian. but again, I would encourage you to engage with the argument of the Reformation as something that has sanctified greed throughout history, as something that has allowed people to see themselves standing on their own feet as a something that they deserve rather than something that is an accident of chance and of birth. I think broadly surveying the speeches, and I'll try not to ramble on for too much longer, there's been a degree of ships passing in the night between the speakers who want to talk about theology and the speakers who want to talk about social and historical consequences of that theology. And I think I would encourage you all to make sure that you're listening to what the other side are saying, and not just, if you want to talk about theology, that's great, but if the other side aren't interested in engaging on theological topics, maybe you need to try and fight them on their strongest turf. One point that I was saddened didn't come up was that no one argued that we should regret the Reformation because it led to the Counter-Reformation, to a polarisation and a hardening of attitudes. One could argue that the Reformation was a problem because it encouraged the Catholic Church to harden its boundaries. Before the Reformation, and I'm sorry again to our rant, there was a good degree of flexibility. I would say don't be taken in by Lutheran propaganda about the nature of the Catholic Church before the Reformation. There was a much greater degree of flexibility, of fluidity within the Catholic Church. And the Reformation led to a closing down of those grey areas and a development of harder boundaries with very profound social as well as theological legacies, not least in Northern Ireland. And I was very interested that none of our speakers really engaged with the context of this place and whether the Reformation was a good or bad thing for Northern Ireland and the people of Northern Ireland. Now, you're to be commended, of course, for considering rather higher-minded issues of theological truth and objective standards of moral behaviour and all the rest of it, but sometimes it's nice to play a bit to the home crowd. So, that's my assessment of the evening. Thank you again to all of our speakers, and I'm looking forward to seeing who's been swayed by them. Thank you very much.
Now we move on to our vote on speaker ability. So this isn't what side you agree with. This is who you thought spoke better tonight and who made the best points. So if you think that the proposition carried the vote on speaker ability tonight, please raise your hand.
Okay, not terrible.
Not
too bad.
What?
There's two people
doing
experiments.
And one. Yeah,
exactly. And if you think that the opposition spoke best tonight, please raise your hand. Up.
Your other two teammates can still.
14.
We'll just go with the highest and biggest.
You don't count.
I got 14. And if you don't think either side spoke best tonight, please raise your hand in abstention.
Damning indictment of the opposition, you can only be against just
a sweet
light.
It's
five.
Five?
Yes.
Five? I said five as well, yes.
You should all count.
So, I'll only vote on prior opinion. Well, not actually opposed opinion, but anyway, there are 18 votes for the proposition, 15 votes for the opposition, and five people weren't listening. So, the proposition is.
So, just one other thing is, sorry to just jump in the way, but when I went last week when Paul Shannon was here, who was the president before Andrew, I forgot to bring along the HLM card for Paul Shannon, which was made about 5 years ago. So I thought that this, considering there's a bunch of old HLM cards on Real Life Events, for those who don't know, that exist, but they haven't actually been given to the people who own them. I thought it'd probably be a good opportunity for this, for you to present this to Andrew.
Oh. So we go on to Lavery's after this. We've got a room booked. And if all the speakers could come to the front so we can get a picture with you as well.
We do not have any spots. Next week is This House Police Walter White acted morally. We have absolutely no spots on the debate. There are no spots for reserve speakers. Similarly, the week following that is This House Police Home Rule with Rome Rule. There are no spots on that or reserve spots.